Hello, and welcome to the AXA-XL Healthcare Risk Insights Podcast. I'm your host, Shalay Hendrickson, Head of Healthcare Bermuda. On today's episode, we are going to discuss managing cybersecurity during COVID-19. I'm excited to share this podcast with Chris Roberts. Chris is considered one of the world's foremost experts on counter-threat intelligence and vulnerability research within the information security industry. Chris is a well-known cybersecurity expert, cyber stuff researcher, advisor, executive consultant, and has been credentialed in many of the top IT information security disciplines. Chris is a cybersecurity advocate and has been featured on media outlets such as CNN, USA Today, Wired, and many others. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Chris, with the expansion of telemedicine during the pandemic, how have cyber risks increased for healthcare organizations utilizing telehealth?
I think we've seen definitely an increase in the amounts and types of attacks that are going on at the moment. Obviously, with everybody being scattered to the four winds to some degree, you know, obviously the critical people are still having to be in a central environment, but with so many people scattered and so much more remote, there's definitely now ample opportunity. And we've seen a huge increase in the number of attacks and number of targeted attacks, not just against healthcare facilities, but obviously against the telehealth systems themselves, where the adversaries and the attackers are obviously trying to exploit any loopholes possible to really just take the data. Yeah, it's definitely become much more focused.
Are there any kinds of attacks that have become more popular or prominent for telehealth?
I think it's a number of different things. We've obviously seen a huge increase in spam. So the emails that actually do make it through your filters and your gateways to really try to encourage people to click something or to click into something or to open something, and thereby basically opening a back door into their own environment. And then obviously from an attacker's standpoint, that then gives them a foothold into a local network, and then they kind of go from there. So huge amount of increase in the attacks in just spam and scam type of attacks. And then we're also seeing a lot of work being done to backdoor and reverse engineer some of the actual telehealth applications that are put on all the portable and mobile devices to see if there's any exploits and ways past it. So really the application layer, which is the visible layer to your end users, your patients, your healthcare providers, and then obviously the back end systems where people are trying to get in through the scams and the attacks.
What are the increased risks for this new work from home environment? Do you feel that healthcare organizations were prepared or that they are managing those increased risks well?
Unfortunately, I think it would lump healthcare into the same as everybody else, which was like, oh, good grief, we didn't see this coming, and what do we do about it? And unfortunately, unlike a lot of industry where the majority of people obviously can work from home, healthcare doesn't have that luxury. You know, so many of the people that we see are on the front line are obviously, you know, we've got the healthcare providers and those that have to interact with patients. So you see this distributed workforce. And now so many people have all of a sudden found themselves working from home. Some of them had the right equipment, and the word is some. And then all of a sudden, you know, the IT department suddenly realized they had a transient population that they had to enable to be able to work. So they didn't have much choice in many cases. So you end up with a lot of people working on their home computers or their home PCs rather than a work issued machine. So now you have all of this influx of what we used to call bring your own device. It isn't a work device, it's your own machine, but you're having to use it for work assets. So you're looking at messaging, you're looking at email, potentially you're looking at healthcare records, you're interacting with a corporate network. So very quickly, a lot of the facilities had to work out how to deal with that because they couldn't go out and buy more computers because everybody else was in the same problem across the entire, you know, range of industries. So very quickly, you had a lot of like remote access work. You had a lot of people using various different remote access tools to get into corporate or into healthcare environments as safely as possible. Then on top of that, obviously, you're sitting at home. You're in a home environment, which is typically a lot more relaxed than a corporate environment. You might have an Alexa at home that's listening to a lot of things. Your home firewall might not be quite as well protected as your work firewall. You have other people on these computers. You have other influences. You don't have them necessarily as well locked down. So all of a sudden, again, the IT departments and the technology departments had to sit down and go, how do we deal with this? How do we still allow people to function, you know, get to healthcare records, get to patient records, get to the healthcare systems, the Epics and the Cerners of this world? And how do we still manage to protect this data as effectively as possible? So that's where very quickly you saw the HIPAA rules and regulations being challenged. And to some degree, there was this, I wouldn't say a loosening, because there really wasn't, but they turned around and said, look, you know, you can be a little more flexible, but you better understand where you are doing this and back it out at some point in time in the future. So the ability to share information effectively, you know, obviously you've got so many healthcare facilities having to deal with these problems, so they obviously have to share information. And again, if you're sharing from a home system to another home system, how do you protect it? How do you deal with encryption? And really, the scenarios have been around for many, many years. You know, we've always talked about disaster recovery. We've always talked about incident response. Unfortunately, not many organizations practice what they preach. So everybody were like, oh, yes, we have a disaster recovery plan. Yet, unfortunately, like most places, they didn't test it, or they didn't test it effectively. Or somebody signed off to say they had a plan and maybe they'd sat around a table across a cup of coffee and discussed it, but they hadn't effectively tested these scenarios. So not many people were very well prepared for this. Even the companies and the organizations that had, say, moved a lot of their work to the cloud, so they were using a much more cloud-centric environment, you still have to deal with people being able to get to data and then obviously collaborate. We all saw the statistics with a lot of the online conferencing system that just going through the roof insofar as utilization, because people didn't realize how they communicated when they were in the office. And now that they're all separated, how do they now effectively communicate when they are dispersed? So, yeah, definitely made for interesting times, unfortunately, and not necessarily very well organized ones, at least for a few weeks. You talk to a lot of the facilities now, and they've definitely got their hands around the core of the challenge, but there's definitely still some issues out there.
What tips do you have for our listeners to reduce vulnerability from increased remote access?
I think, you know, the first and foremost thing, it all comes down to education. I think that's one of the biggest things I think that we miss. You know, we tend to do education to our end users and to our population maybe once a year. Unfortunately, we tell them, don't click on this, don't send it, or else. What we tend not to do is help people understand how to protect themselves. You know, with the increase in spam and the scam emails, we're not good at teaching people how to responsibly click on something or how to check to see if something is official or legitimate. We've obviously seen a huge increase in ransomware attacks and various other things like that. And that unfortunately comes in because you exploit the human and their interaction with the computer. And a lot of that, again, comes down to training. So I think that's one thing. Secondly, I think is the awareness and the eyes on the infrastructure. I had an amazing conversation with somebody yesterday, funnily enough, where, you know, distributed workforce, and they have folks who are seeing anomalies. So, you know, they've got a distributed amount of people out there, and some of them are seeing, well, my mouse is moving on its own, or my system is doing this kind of thing, or I've got something odd going on. And so the question then becomes one of, well, how do you know what it's doing? And unless you have eyes effectively on the inside of your environment to understand, you know, what's my Active Directory doing? So my authentication system, what's happening on my servers, and what's happening on my ingress and my egress filters, so my firewalls and my gateways and my mail proxies. Unless you've got really good eyes on those, you're not really going to understand your environment very well. The third one would be, you know, again, you've got a distributed workforce. Do you know now, not just where all the assets are, so where all the devices are, but how well are you tracking where that data is flowing so that when we eventually do come out of this, and let's face it, we will come out of this at some point, how are you able to now understand how well that distributed data is moving? And especially when people say, nope, I'm actually going to carry on working from home because I don't need an hour and a half's commute into the office. How are you going to manage those people effectively with their data and what they do? So some lessons to be learned on data handling, data management, and data standards, but even just some of the basic stuff. You know, we tend to preach it in the security arena is, you know, the back to basics principle, the network separation, the network segmentation, the ability for user education, you know, passwords. You know, as an industry, security is 25, 30-ish years old. We can go back a lot further, but arguably we're 25, 30 years old. And yet the top 20 most used passwords is still topped by a password of 123456. So we as an industry have not done a good job of helping people understand how to effectively use identity management and password control systems. So just some simple stuff that we still haven't managed to get through to people. So, you know, we're back to the communication collaboration issues that we're not good at. So a lot of human related stuff and not a huge amount that we want to throw technology at, to be perfectly honest.
Chris, as a security professional, organizations ask you to place yourself in the shoes of the attacker. Can you explain things through the eyes of the criminal in terms of ransomware?
No, I think just the opportunistic side of things. I mean, you know, I'll be honest, if I was an attacker or an adversary, the age-old saying of make hay while the sun shines, this is a perfect example of that. You know, you have a scattered workforce who haven't fully been trained on awareness, and you have a lot of organizations. I mean, you have thousands, tens of thousands of organizations out there that are having to work in a different way. And so you haven't trained them effectively. So as an adversary and as an attacker, I will be sending out messages left, right, and center, and I'll have them payloaded. Because, you know, somebody's going to pay up really quickly, especially if I hit a healthcare facility. People are going to pay, and they're going to pay quickly, and it's going to be good money. So quite honestly, I would have a list of every single healthcare facility, every single third-party provider. Because remember, I'm not just going to take out the main facility. I'll take out the third-party provider. And I'd be sending my payloaded messages and my PDFs and my emails and everything that really has the ability to attack you. I'd be sending that stuff out left, right, and center because you are a critical part of the infrastructure, much more so now, and therefore you have to function. So if I'd cut you, but I don't cut you too deeply, you'll pay. So I still send them out, and I send them out for a couple of hundred thousand. I'm going to be raking in the money. And there's a lot of people who want to profit off of this, and we've seen it, unfortunately.
Chris, do you recommend that companies hold funds specifically in case of a ransomware demand?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Because, I mean, you see how many organizations have, obviously, cyber liability insurance. We deal with it on a regular basis. I mean, there's a couple of companies out there that specifically are set up to negotiate the payments with the adversaries. Because, obviously, typically it's in Bitcoin or some other kind of digital currency. I would say look at the cyber liability insurance policy that you have very carefully. Work with the insurance provider that you have and understand what your liabilities are. I mean, I know with me, you know, because I run a consulting company, I know what my risks are, I know what my liabilities are. I know I would have to pay out of pocket before I can turn to the insurance company and say, hey, I'm afraid the rest of this is on you and I've done everything I possibly can. So I would definitely make sure that any organization has at least that much on hand to cover the amount they'd be out of pocket in this.
How much funds should be readily available for ransomware demands?
Ugh. I mean, if you think about it, cyber liability should cover most of it. But I mean, we're seeing everything from a couple of hundred thousand up to several million. One of the organizations I work for, and I do a lot of, I'm sitting on like the virtual CISO for the organization. We unfortunately have to deal with ransomware and recovery on an almost daily basis. There's about three of us who do a lot of this work, and we're seeing 100, 150 plus cases every single month coming through. And, you know, some of them are coming through for 100 to 300,000 US dollars. And the rest of them are coming through for a couple of million at a time. You know, as an industry, unfortunately, in the security space, we've arguably, because of this mess, we've failed. We haven't done a good enough job of trying to protect the organizations. But conversely, I would argue that a lot of the organizations haven't effectively listened to what we've been saying. I mean, there's definitely, we have a problem because we haven't communicated effectively what the problems, how bad this can be. And unfortunately, the companies, like humans ourselves, aren't willing to accept some of the cold, hard truths until they themselves suffer. So it's an unfortunate situation.
Do you think healthcare organizations are the primary target for cyber criminals during COVID-19?
They're definitely more opportunistic, no two ways about it. But I think, yeah, I mean, by far and away, because again, it's, you are one of the organizations on the tip. You know, you are on the front line. We are sitting here. It sucks really because we're sitting in there and there's not much we can do. You know, we are told to stay healthy, stay indoors, and we're doing the best we can. But you almost feel like you want to be out there fighting. But unfortunately, that puts even more people at risk. So by having to take this approach, you know, healthcare's on the front line, no two ways about it, along with a lot of the other, you know, basically critical systems. So they are definitely being targeted more, but I would say not exclusively. We've seen a huge uptick in the small and medium business attacks, like a huge uptick in the amount of small SMB market. So those with like, you know, 2,000 people or under, or like a billion cap or something like that. Just, I mean, left, right, and center, every single day, somebody somewhere is clicking on something, and the next thing they know is their entire environment goes down, and they don't have good backups, and they don't have a plan in place, and unfortunately, then we get a phone call. Yeah, I mean, healthcare is the big one. Obviously, critical infrastructure is still getting hit pretty heavily. You know, everybody tends to focus on the electrical grid, yet everybody tends to ignore the fact that obviously part of critical infrastructure is water, sewage, and everything else, and you know, there's definitely an uptick in those types of attacks as well.
Chris, can you tell us a bit more about how the attackers look at the opportunities within the current environment with COVID? What are the attackers thinking right now? What do they see that we don't see?
We see this, unfortunately, all too often, even outside of a pandemic environment, which is where we always tend to look at the adversary and go, how are they able to get in so often? How are they able to do so much? But when you break it down, the adversary is very well coordinated. Let's say I wanted to attack you and your organization. I'm not going to sit here having to build my own tools, find my own exploits and do everything else. I'm going to go out onto basically the open market. I am going to buy an exploit that will allow me to, you know, send you a spreadsheet or a PDF or a document or a link that will get into your computer. I will then maybe buy a payload that does certain things, be it a ransomware attack or be it something looking for data. I will buy time on a channel, so a set of computers that then communicates with my attack tools that I've bought to tell them what to do and to either ransomware and siphon off. Then when I have started to do this, I'm going to lease the services of somebody who can then do all the financial transactions for me. So as an attacker, I'm basically shopping for services, and I'm organized because you've got some amazing people out there who have decided that that life is, and it is much more profitable, unfortunately, that it's more profitable and it's an easier way to do things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a well set up network of people and organizations where I can rent and lease and buy these services for. Conversely, and unfortunately, on our side of the fence, so the defensive teams and the blue teams that are out there, we don't always have good intelligence as to what's going on. Unfortunately, when, you know, company number one gets hit, they don't put their hand up and go, learn from us, learn from me. I got hit with this type of ransomware. For goodness sakes, don't leave the same port open, don't click on the same document, update your firewalls, rules, configs, whatever. They tend to hunker down, the lawyer says you're not allowed to say anything, and nobody wants to help their neighbor, which is hugely unfortunate in this world that we live in. And also to that point as well, you know, from a resource standpoint, the blue and the defensive teams don't necessarily have enough people on staff to do the work that's necessary, especially now that we're in a pandemic environment where, again, you've got a scattered workforce. So they're stretched thin as it is. Now you've introduced even more issues. They don't necessarily have all the tools they need, and that's human tools as well as technology tools. And we have a distributed workforce. You know, and as an attacker, I literally only have to be right once. I send it out to 1,000 people. I only need one or two people to click on it. Yet as a defensive person, I have to be right literally every single time. Or I have to assume that I'm going to be breached and I have to have built my entire environment so that it can manage that. So then you start looking at deception technology, you start looking at how well your detection technology is, you start looking at how well is my Active Directory protected, how well are my people trained, how well, you know, what have I done from an endpoint standpoint? And we're not there. We are not there. So we're always on the back foot against an adversary who, unfortunately, you know, is good at communicating, effective at tool sharing, and knows the space arguably better than we do.
How should a breach response plan be altered during a pandemic?
So I think there's a couple of things. I think definitely communication and collaboration platforms are key. You know, one of the biggest things we found during a pandemic, and actually during any time that the workforce is scattered, is how do we effectively communicate and collaborate? So, you know, we've gone through it. We've all found 10 different communication platforms and collaboration platforms. Number one, I would love to see a consolidation in that space so that we can all actually communicate effectively across maybe one or two platforms. So that's number one. I think number two is not just collaboration and communication inside the one company that you work for, but how do you use, you know, maybe somebody like you guys or a consolidation point to go, hey, we have a problem. How can we help the community? You know, we have the ISACers and we have, you know, you guys, we have a lot of other people out there. And I think what would be fantastic would be to have some kind of centralized collaboration point where it's like, hey, I can't release this officially yet, but we just got hit with this ransomware. And here's the problem. Here's what you should see on your signatures. Adjust accordingly. So that's going to slow down an attacker being able to go after 10 or 15 companies using the same tools and technology. So I think that's definitely part of it. I think a better set of tests. So you have an incident response plan, test them. If you don't have an incident response plan, there's enough of us out there that can help you build them. There's a lot of work that we are doing with the insurance companies and with the healthcare space and a few other spaces to help them better understand their risks. And, you know, one of them is obviously, have you tested your plan? Have you tested it effectively? And let's actually sit down for a day. And let's take half a day with the tech folks and half a day with the business folks and just run through some scenarios. Let's actually test this plan and see where the holes are and how we can learn. And we do that in a collaborative way. I think the biggest challenge, we always talk about penetration testing and assessments and all this kind of stuff. So much of that is adversarial that you know, you're like, oh, good grief, they're doing a pen test. It's like an audit. The auditor's coming in. Can we shut them in a room and feed them enough stuff until they give us a tick in the box? That doesn't help anybody. It doesn't serve any purpose. It's no use whatsoever. And all we are doing is fooling ourselves. What I'd much rather see is, hey, let's bring the auditor in or the assessment team in and let's sit down with them and what can we learn from them? And conversely, those people have to come in and go, how can we help you? So it's all about changing. It's like, okay, how do we collaborate more effectively? How do we communicate more effectively? What do we have in place from an incident response standpoint? Who can we pick up the phone to and what can we do ourselves? And then who can we notify? So basically, better procedures and controls is a big part of it.
Thank you, Chris. There is certainly a lot for us to focus on. If you could, would you look into the crystal ball and tell us what healthcare professionals might look at as the next set of risks?
I'm actually giving a talk next week on human hacking. It's something I've been messing with for a number of years. I did a lot of work years ago on the nanotech and bio-nanotech world, on actually how to hack all the carbon molecular stuff that the healthcare world is working on. And then I fast forwarded, I've done a bunch of work on EEG. So pulling signals out of the brain, directly out of the brain, and then, you know, through tools and technology. But I honestly think, I mean, you think about where we are going with augmentation. So from a human standpoint, we already have pacemakers, hearts, defibrillators, we have insulin pumps. We have technology now that when I do an implant, I will put a chipset in there that will either use some kind of wireless type signal to actually tell a physician's office whether it's actually implanting properly or whether there's a problem with it. So now you take that to the next logical step. We already have chips that go into ears to help hearing. We have chips that are used to help Alzheimer's patients. And these are amazing advances in technology. But with those advances in technology come all of the holes and problems that we see today. I arguably think the next step is we're going to start ransoming the very humans themselves. So that's going to be an interesting one. And hopefully technology catches up with the simple need for us to protect humans. And we actually put people and process before technology. And we start thinking about, you know, what are we doing and how do we better safeguard the human?
Chris, it was a pleasure to have you join the podcast today. You have provided us with cybersecurity insights that I trust will be useful to our listeners.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the AXA-XL Healthcare Risk Insights podcast. Stay tuned for future podcasts where we will dive into other current and developing risks impacting the healthcare industry.